Tuesday, January the 14th, was an absolutely unique day in my 34 years in Washington. It was the day Lyndon gave his last State of the Union speech, and I suppose his last appearance in the historic old House chamber in an official position. It began in New York in the Pierre. Lyndon had gone back after the party late the night before, and I had spent the night, and in the morning read leisurely the lovely stories about our glittering party the night before, and then began to call Ashton to invite the guests who would sit with me at the State of the Union speech. Every year, these guests are chosen with great care and have a very special meaning. Tonight, I did not have to think at all. I knew who I wanted without any shadow of a doubt, my staff. So I began by asking Bess and Liz and Ashton, and then went on to the wives of Lyndon's staff members. They themselves can go on the floor, but not the wives. So I asked Clay McPherson, whose husband Harry had been laboring on the speech, George Christian's wife, Joanne, and dear Elspeth Rostow, whose husband has worked harder and endured more of the ordeals connected with these 5 years than anyone, I think, except possibly Rusk. And Edwina and Mrs. Middleton, whose husbands are going to Texas with us, and Dr. Chester Newland, the director of the library, and Diana MacArthur and June White, and Marie and Mary Rather, those two wonderful people that I always want to make room for in anything that is close to us. It took a number of calls to readjust and plan the seats. I decided to put Linda on my right and Elspeth next to her, and ask Lucy to sit on a step seat on my left. Years of State of the Union pictures have proved that the eye of the TV camera bores in on this step seat, the number one seat, and then along the first row. And then I tried on my inaugural dress, a less than exciting business. I wanted to look proud and elegant, but there was no great importance about the costume this year. A little past 12, I left the Pierre with Bess, and as we waited for the Secret Service car out front, the doorman looked at us with half attention and said, "Does anybody want a taxi?" No flurry, no ripple of excitement as I passed. Portent of things to come? I could settle into this easy. We went home on the shuttle, and at the White House, had lunch on a tray with Lucy in my room, worked with Ashton in the afternoon, asked the kitchen to have a pickup supper, a buffet that we could eat on trays because it is our habit to return from State of the Unions, staff and friends, and sit around and listen to the evaluation of the message. Lyndon spent a good deal of the afternoon down in the theater practicing the speech, and part of it in bed resting and going over the final drafts. He seemed very weary, and has this past month or so, almost as though now that he's so near the finish, he could afford to show it, at least to those close around him. I was to leave for the Capitol about 8:30. Lyndon would follow in one of those split-second timed tour de force arrivals that brings him into the chamber at the exact moment. Years of experience have taught me that these are hard on the nerves, and so I go earlier. And thus it was about 8:15 when the traumatic part of the evening began for me. Always, I think, and especially since last March the 31st, I have lived fully, deeply, the drama of our situation, of the events that have buffeted our country, and the part we have shared in them, have been tuned in on the tragedy and the glory, the warmth and color and pain of these times. But I have kept an impassive face, I think, a rather dignified face, but I have said to myself that sometimes I would cry. But it would probably be when some third-rate class in some little community broke out into America, and not at any great state occasion, not at any glittering event. Well, tonight I did cry in public, on TV, and with an audience of several million, I expect. So much for cool assurance and high resolve. It was approaching 8:30 when Lucy brought little Patrick Lynn in to kiss his grandfather and tell him goodbye. He had on his pajamas. Lyndon looked at him surprised and says, "Isn't he going up to the State of the Union?" Lucy said, "No, Daddy, we thought it best," and I broke in, horrified, and said, "No, dear, I don't think we'd better take that little boy up there." Lyndon looked up at us, rather pathetic, in fact, and said, "Have I asked you to use any other seat for anybody?" He hadn't. I had disposed of every one.
Lucy said, "All right, Daddy," threw me a desperate glance, and went out with Patrick Lynn in her arms.
And so began the evening.
In about 5 minutes, she had him in one of his many cute little outfits, and together we started for the Capitol.
Linda, Lucy, Lynn, and I in the back seat of the big black car.
And as it rapidly consumed the short distance to the Capitol, we looked at each other and said, "What are we going to do?"
Tonight was important to all of us.
Lynn had been becoming increasingly rambunctious and adorable as he is. I felt that he'd been exposed a bit too much to cameras and crowds and newspaper stories, was inclined to wind up inappropriately on center stage.
"What shall we do?" we all said, looking at each other.
"Lucy, we'd better phone back to the White House and get Olga to follow us within 10 or 15 minutes if she can, and stand outside the gallery and be ready to take him after he's been there just a few minutes. His grandfather can see him as he walks in, and then we'll just let him disappear, and Olga can take him to that nice ladies' restroom that's on the same floor for the 45 or so minutes of the speech. Can you work that out, Jerry?"
Jerry could and would, and got on the phone with instructions.
And then we began to talk about how on earth could we, sitting on the front row with Lynn, get him back to the door of the gallery, since every aisle seat would be filled with a body. Jerry put in cheerfully. We could pass him over our heads, hand over hand. And on that delightful word picture of an accompaniment to the State of the Union message, we drove up to the side door of the great old Capitol building. There was Lucy's friend of school days, who used to be a Senate page named Anderson, who escorted us from the car down the aisles and into the elevators, and presently Fishbait Miller. How can we possibly ever have a State of the Union message if Fishbait is no longer there? As we were whisked down the aisles, I could see little crowds of people gathered behind the barriers, all waving, some calling out. And then we were asked to wait in an upper hall for a few moments, because timing is important in this great pageantry. And then we got the signal, and I led the way into the box, pausing to look down below me on the assembled House and Senate of the United States in that dear, familiar chamber. And then below me, they began to rise and clap and broke out into cheering on both sides, Republican and Democrat. I looked to right and left, my eyes sweeping the whole chamber below me, acknowledging with warmth and, I hope, dignity, their standing ovation, and then picked my way carefully down the steps between the wives of the members of the Supreme Court and our cabinet, and past my own guests, and took my seat on the front row with Linda on my right and Lucy on the step beside me, Patrick Lynn on her lap, leaned over to speak to Muriel. The hands of the clock stood at about 10 to 9. From then on, the evening began to disintegrate for me. Hopelessly, irreparably, Lynn crawled over his mother's lap, over mine, waved his bottle of milk in one arm and his book in the other, reached for the railing that separated him from the void below. We were the front row with a drop of some 20 feet or so to the floor of the chamber below us. In the press box to our right, I was aware of all the heads turning as though at a tennis match, eyes trained on our performance. I could see the face of Francis Lewin, Helen Thomas, Betty Beale, and then Mary McGrory, mouth open, incredulous. Lynn gave his milk bottle a particularly hefty swing. I thought, oh Lord, what if he should drop it on one of the legislators below? Perhaps H.R. Gross or Senator Williams? What an ignominious departure from this town. Lucy threw me a martyred look, and Lindbergh gave her attention elsewhere as though she didn't belong to the group. Only Lynn remained blissfully, innocently unaware that he was causing a furor, as he continued to climb around over us and gurgle and respond to everybody's attention. I began to laugh, helplessly, irresistibly, holding my handkerchief in front of my mouth, trying in that extremely conspicuous spot to be inconspicuous. Tears were streaming down my face. I couldn't help it. My eyes were drawn irresistibly back to the press box. Mary McGrory's expression remained frozen. I have lived with her acerbic columns comfortably enough for 5 years. What I know or believe is untrue, wrong, doesn't bother me. But to read one of them tomorrow, describing with her cutting sarcasm our last appearance, and to have to agree with it, that would be the bitter end.
Meanwhile, the pageantry unfolded below me with scant attention from me. About 5 minutes of nine, Fishballing Miller's stentorian voice announced the Diplomatic Corps, and in marched Sevilla Sacasa at their head, followed by a pretty full contingent who took their places right below us on the right of the chamber. And then the Supreme Court sitting down front, and then Lyndon's cabinet. And did I imagine a special wave of applause as Dean Rusk came in? I think not. I think it was real and warm. Whatever the rancors of these years, he goes out with the respect of this town, even, I think, its admiration, but sometimes grudging. Fishbait's voice rang out, "The President of the United States." The chamber rose. A wave of applause washed across it, was sustained. Down the aisle came Lyndon, following the committee that led him in, turning to the right and left, smiling, waving, pausing to shake hands now and then. He went to the speaker's stand and paused a full several moments to absorb, receive the ovation, the farewell of the members of the House and Senate, so many of whom had shared his working life for years are decades. It was a good speech, and I was increasingly glad that he had decided to come here and make it, and not just send up a paper. At first, it was too slow. It grew in tempo and appeal as he went along. They liked it when he said it had been 38 years since he first stood in the House chamber as a doorkeeper in the galleries. And I think we all liked it. We felt it was fair and generous when he said that President Nixon will need your understanding just as I did. I liked the forthright statement that there had been some disappointments, some failures of achievement. I liked it best of all, and I particularly relished looking at my two daughters when he said, "I cannot speak of Vietnam without paying a personal tribute to the men who have carried the battle for us there. I have been honored to be their commander-in-chief." The applause swelled through the chamber. I like to think that line was directed straight up to my right and to my left. Lucy, of course, was back by this time, about 10 minutes after Lyndon had begun. She had scooped up Lyndon and somehow managed to make her way up the crowded aisle and give him to Alger outside the door. As all good speeches should, the ending was the best. It was something like this: "I hope it may be said 100 years from now that together we help to make our country more just for all its people, as well as to ensure the blessings of liberty for our posterity. I believe it will be said that we tried." I looked around me, satisfied. Bess, on the front row, was frankly crying. There were tears in lots of eyes, but I had long since ceased. I led the way to the elevator. The newspaper ladies crowding around, all wanting a quote, tried to produce something sensible for them. "I loved what Betty Beale said the next day. It was a night for cheers, for tears, for recollections, for regrets, for forgiveness. And it was Lyndon Johnson's night. It had been." I could sense Linda and Lucy coming along behind me, Lucy chattering at ease and at full speed. She gets along well with newspaper people. They like each other, I think. Linda, quieter, preferring to say nothing if she could. The Secret Service led us down to the Speaker's office, as always, and there was assembled, along with the Speaker and Miss Harriet in her chair, barely able to rise, the leadership, Hale Boggs, Carl Albert. I was glad to see Senator McGee, who'll be back on foreign relations. We spoke quickly to as many as we could reach, and then left hurriedly to return to the second floor, carrying staff and friends with us, ready for the last act of a State of the Union night. That is, the gathering where you get the reviews. Lyndon went to his bedroom and had the TV on there, the three-faced one. I had one on in the West Hall. Bess and Tyler came, and Dr. Newland, and Tom and Edwina Johnson, and the George Christians, Jim Jones and Larry Temple, Marie and Harry and Clay and Mary, and Walt and Elspeth Rostow, and Bill and June White, and of course, Lucy and Linda. I watched a roundtable discussion of the speech in which I think it was Schlesinger and Jack Valenti and Bill Moyers and some nutty man from the Village Voice
In general, the reviews were good, and I closed the page on the day with a feeling of satisfaction. This had hung in the balance for a while, and I'm glad the decision was made as it had been. It had been a good speech, a good performance, a great exit, I thought. We all went in the dining room and loaded our plates from the ample buffet. We sat around in the West Hall and on the floor and wherever anyone could find a chair, saying our goodbyes to each other and the time, and I, at least, to this room, for this is the last Tuesday I will be here in this capacity, and probably ever.